Good morning. If you have a Bible, maybe you would like to turn to the book of John. That's where we're going to be this morning. And we're going to mainly be in chapter 4. But when I was up here last time, I spoke about how important it is to get into our Bible, and some of it we read quickly. But the book of John is one of those books that we read slowly because there is so much packed into there that we need to take time to meditate on it. So I want to give a bit of context as to where we are in John chapter 4 by quickly giving some highlights from John chapters 1, 2, and 3 that you may want to go away and study this week if you're looking for something to look at and to get into this week. So the book of John is fantastic, and it's quite fast-paced, and it starts with this amazing piece of poetry, this theological poetry, when John writes, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And so straight away, John is saying, using those words, "in the beginning," which are the exact three words that Genesis starts with. So we've got that link there of John saying, actually, Jesus, remember, he was concealed in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, in the beginning was the Word. The Word is Jesus. And he is concealed in the Old Testament. But now John is saying, he is here. I am making him known. He purposefully chooses those same three words. So in the beginning was the Word. The Word was God. And the Word was with God. We get that idea of Trinity. We get that idea of God not just being one being, one person, but actually he is more than that. He is Trinitarian, which is core to our Christian belief. And so we see that Jesus was with God in the beginning, and that just blows our mind, doesn't it? And you could spend the rest of our lives looking and trying to grapple with this idea of Trinity and how God is three in one. And it just doesn't compute in our human brains, but it's in there and it's true. And then he says about Jesus, or this Word, being the light and shining in the darkness. And that's all John really says about Christmas. He says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, or tabernacled among us. And that idea of the Israelites going through in Exodus with their tabernacle that they were traveling through. John is now saying that Jesus is the tabernacle. Jesus is the temple. He's come in flesh and he's tabernacling, if that's a real word, with us. He's moving. He's come into the neighborhood. I think it's the Message Bible who says it's God with flesh or God with skin on. And I just love that idea as well. And then he introduces this other man called John the Baptist, and he quickly goes through his life and he explains how this man was a messenger who came to talk about this Word, to talk about this light who was coming, to be a witness. And then people started thinking that John was the Messiah. And John says this great phrase. He says, "No, I am not he. I'm not worthy to untie his sandals. I must decrease, so he must increase." And isn't that true in our life? We need to make sure that we do not take the place of Jesus, but that we humble ourselves. And we've spoken about that before as well, haven't we? It's one of our values. We lead humbly so that people can see Jesus, not us. So, in fact, John has built up this group of followers. And he says to his disciples, to two of them particularly, he says, I'm not the Messiah. He is. Go and find him. Go and follow him. And John almost just gives his ministry that he's built up over, we're not sure how long, but he gives his ministry to Jesus. And John's disciples start following Jesus instead. And then Jesus starts his ministry about age 30. And we get him going around and calling his first disciples. And then he goes to a wedding in Cana where they've run out of wine. And that very famous passage where Jesus tells the servants to go and get the ceremonial washing jars and to fill them up to the brim and to bring them back. And they take them to the host of the wedding, and it turns into wine. And it's a symbol of how Jesus has come to change us, to wash us, to ceremonial clean us so that we can be worshipped to him, and how Jesus provides the wine. And later on in the Last Supper, Jesus says, this wine, this is my body, this is my blood, this is given for you. And so right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he is saying, I'm going to provide wine for you. And then again at that Last Supper, he says, I will provide the cup again. I will not drink it until I'm in heaven. Jesus is the bridegroom. It was the bridegroom's job. He had one job to sort the wine out, and he messed it up. And Jesus steps in and says, I am the bridegroom, and I will provide wine that will never end. And that wine will satisfy you forever. So we have that story of the wedding in Cana. And then these other people start coming to Jesus, and he starts teaching them. And then in chapter 3, he meets this man called Nicodemus who doubts and he can't quite get his head around who Jesus is. And he says, can anything good come from Galilee, come from Nazareth? And Jesus speaks to him and he reveals to him how he saw him sat under the fig tree. And that fig tree was his shelter and his shade. And the first time we have mention of the fig tree is in the garden where they took leaves off the trees to cover themselves because they were ashamed of being naked. And fig tree is a sign of covering. And Nicodemus was sat under the fig tree, under the covering, and it wasn't good enough. And Jesus called him out and said, I'll give you a better covering. Come follow me and we'll change the world together. So Jesus isn't just a fig tree that temporarily covers our sin and covers our mistakes. Jesus is that sacrificial lamb that God had to kill to make coverings of skin for Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis. So Jesus is showing again how he's not just temporary, he is permanent. He is someone who will completely cover up and solve and satisfy the things that have gone wrong in our life and give us complete healing. And then we get to chapter 4. And Jesus starts with chapter 4, he goes to a country called Samaria. And the Samaritans weren't liked by the Israelites, and the Israelites weren't liked by the Samaritans. They didn't get on with each other well at all, because they believed that the Samaritans were dirty people, were mixed people, were infiltrated with sin, and they weren't holy, they weren't Jewish, they weren't quite Jews, and they weren't quite Gentiles. They couldn't get their heads around it. And they had these different beliefs, but some of the beliefs were still the same. So Jesus starts talking, and the woman at the well, she says, I know the Messiah is coming. She's looking for someone, but she doesn't know who. And she's lived her life waiting for someone to come and searching for that thing. And she's been looking in all the wrong places. And Jesus says, you've been looking for that relationship with other men. You've been married numerous times. You're living with a man now who's not your husband. And you've not found that happiness. And Jesus just sits with her for a while. And he spends time talking to her. And he reassures her of who she is. He gives her value. He gives her worth. He gives her identity. He gives her hope and a future. And he says, I am the Messiah. And she goes away and she tells all her friends, come meet the man who knew all things about me. And she impacts and witnesses to Samaria. And then he goes on from there. And it doesn't really mention it in John's gospel, but he goes down to Jerusalem and he turns the tables over and he cleanses the temple. And people have started to see the things that Jesus has done. And he starts to draw a crowd. So when we get to verse 46, where I want to read from, Jesus has gone back to Cana, where he has had that wedding feast, and he's done his first miracle. He's been down to Jerusalem via Samaria, and he's come back to Cana, and it says this. So when he came again to Cana in Galilee, verse 46, where he had made water into wine, and at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judah in Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, unless you see the signs and wonders, you will not believe. The official said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. And Jesus said to him, go. Your child will live. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour and when he began to get better. And then they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour, which was the day started at 6 in the morning, so the seventh hour was 1 in the afternoon. At the seventh hour, the fever left him. The father knew that the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live, that was the hour when Jesus said, your son will live. And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he came from Judah to Galilee. So here we have this crowd of people who have started to gather around Jesus. And the reason they've come is because they've seen the things that he's done. It says it in that previous verse. It said, when they welcomed him, having seen that all he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. So they had heard rumors, they had seen little things of what Jesus was doing, how he was starting to stir things up, how he was starting to teach, and he's in Cana, so they would have heard of the miracles. And he's gone back to Cana, and this crowd has started to gather around him. And in the crowd, there's this one man who it says has come from Capernaum, this royal official, probably from King Herod, who would have been the king at that time. There would have been three kings of Israel at that time. When Herod the Great, who was the king at Christmas, when he died, he divided the kingdom into three, and he gave it to each of his sons. And so Herod, from the crucifixion story, when Jesus goes to him, was the king at this time. And so this official was from Herod's palace. We're not sure too much about him. He might have been is one of his personal assistants. He might have been a military assistant. We don't really know too much about him. But what we do know is he has heard about Jesus, and he's heard about the things that he does. And Jesus has started to make Capernaum specifically his base. And in Matthew chapter 9, I think verse 1, it says that Jesus went to his own town, which was Capernaum. And if you go to Capernaum today, not that I have, but I Googled it and it is on there, there's a sign and it says, "Welcome to Capernaum, the home of Jesus." So Jesus started to make Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee his base. And so this official had heard about him, and he knew that his son was dying, and I imagine that he would have tried everything he could to find a solution to his son's illness. I imagine he'd been to the doctors. Imagine he'd been to the local rabbi. He'd said prayers at the synagogue. I imagine he tried all the medicines he could, and there was nothing that he could find to save his son. And so he heard that Jesus was in Cana, which is about 17 miles away, which walking would probably have taken 7 or 8 hours, particularly on the way there, because Capernaum was down by the river, or down by the lake, and Cana was up in the hill. So the whole journey would have been largely uphill. So this man has walked or ridden on a horse or a donkey or however, as fast as he could, I imagine, to get to Cana. And later in the story, we find out that this conversation happens at in the seventh hour. And if it takes 7 hours to get there, I can imagine him getting up in the morning and saying to his wife, "I've got to go. It's first light. As soon as I can, I'm getting on my horse. I'm getting my sandals on, and I'm getting to Cana as quickly as I can." And he reaches Cana and he says to Jesus, "Jesus, my son is dying. I'm begging you, please come with me. I've tried everything else. I can't solve it myself. Can you come with me?" And this man wants Jesus to come with him. So Jesus is surrounded by this crowd of people who are looking for him to do something. And three times in the book of John already, we have this phrase. Either Jesus uses it or the people around him use it. And it's sort of like, "What do you want me to do?" Jesus sort of uses those words in Cana when he speaks to Mary. And Mary says, "Come on, you can do something about this wine problem." Jesus said, "Woman, what do you want me to do about it?" But three times already, this word of "what do you want me to do" has been given in terms of Jesus' ministry. And that's what the people were looking for. They were looking for something. They were looking for what they could get from Jesus. They wanted to be entertained. These miracles had drawn a crowd. And Jesus was saying, what have you come here for? And he says, "You will not believe unless you see signs and wonders." So Jesus is fully aware that the people have gathered there, not necessarily to hear him talk at this point, but just to be entertained, and to see the signs of wonders that he has been doing, to see him physically turning water into wine and turning over the tables and causing these problems. And they are looking for something to entertain them. They want to see something. And the man, he comes and he says, "I want you to heal my son, but you need to come with me." And I love the sense of humor of God. I love how we ask him for things and he does them, but not in the way we expect. Because the crowd never see this miracle. They've come. They want to see the signs and wonders, and Jesus does the miracle from a distance, and they don't see it. This man has come and said, "I want you to come with me." And Jesus says, "I've got things to do here. I'm not coming, but I will still heal your son." Jesus worked in the way they weren't expecting. And how true is that in our lives as well? How often do we beg and plead with God and say, "God, I really need you to move in this situation. I really need you to work in my workplace and to with this issue with my boss," or whatever it is. And you're expecting him to do it in a certain way, and he gives you a different job or a promotion or moves you elsewhere. And he solves that issue, but not in the way that you think and imagine. I remember when I was on my final year of university, and I was on my final teaching placement, and it wasn't going well. Let's just say it wasn't going well. I was on the road to fail, okay? And I was so depressed, I think, and everything I tried was going wrong. I didn't have a very supportive teacher or tutor, or the university couldn't help me in my situation. And the decision was made that I would pull out of my final teaching placement before I failed it. And that day, I can remember going home to Rhiannon and just thinking, I've tried everything I can. I've been up till 3-4 o'clock in the morning, trying everything I can to get through this teaching placement. I get to work, I'm absolutely exhausted, and nothing goes right. I'm not getting any support. I've now been pulled out of university. I don't know where I stand. I've wasted 3 years of my life at university. And yet the college said, you can redo your placement in 6 months' time, and you can have another shot at it. So I've gone from failure to this little bit of hope. And when I went to this to meet with my university tutor, he said, we've got these two schools you can choose from, neither of which were schools that I really wanted to work in, if I'm particularly honest. But they said, you can get the choice this time. Which school do you want to work in? And that's unheard of. Usually, you're just told where to go. And I chose this school, and I went. It didn't have a very good reputation. And I went to this school, and the 6 weeks teaching placement went as well as they could have done. And I came out with the best mark I could have physically got from that placement, which meant I graduated 6 months later. So instead of in the summer, I was graduating in the December, which meant when I was applying, when I was applying for jobs, all of my colleagues, all of my other students had already got their jobs or had already given up on teaching, and they weren't chasing me for this job. So I went into a job interview where there was hardly any other candidates because they were all in jobs already. So I walked into this job in this little Catholic school in Churchtown. And so God had taken me from this situation where everything seemed dark, give me a little bit of hope, give me a degree that I couldn't have bettered in my personal self. I couldn't have got any better than that grade. He'd given me a job where I met a colleague who said, why don't you come along to City Church? We know I wasn't very happy at the church. We were exhausted. We were doing too much. And the colleague said, why don't you come along? Just use our church for a few weeks, for a few months, and just rest, just relax. That didn't happen. Okay, but he said, why don't you come along to City Church and be with us here? And that was 8 years ago. And so God took this situation where I thought, I'm just wasting my life. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what I'm doing here. And he's taken us full circle. And now we're thinking, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what I'm doing, but it's much more hopeful. And I know that God has set these foundations in place for whatever is coming next. And I don't know what's next, but I do know that God holds the future. And I know that whatever worries, whatever concerns, whatever troubles I have in my life and in our life, God is working them for good. And he's not just a God who sits back and says, yeah, all right, I'll do that. He's not a vending machine. We can't say a certain prayer and God answers it in the same way every time. God is a man. God is a being. God is a spirit who loves us, and he wants the best for us. We sang it. You're a good, good father. That's who you are. He can't help but bless us, and he wants the best for his children, which is us. So the sense of humor of God, of how he works in unexpected ways, I think is clear in this passage, where the people are looking for something. They want to see this sign and wonder, and Jesus says, I'll do it, but not in the way you expect. And I think we can bring hope from that. But John also uses this phrase, signs and wonders. And as I was reading this and sort of meditating upon it, reading it slowly, this phrase I couldn't get out of my head. Why does John use this phrase, signs and wonders? Why didn't he say, unless you see the miracles that I do, or unless you see the works that I do, as he does in a few verses earlier, unless you see the deeds that I do, as he does elsewhere? Why does he use this word, signs and wonders? And I think it's because the sign is something that points to something, isn't it? And when Jesus started his ministry, and he was in the synagogue, and if you remember, he opened up the scroll to Isaiah 61, and he said, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to release the chains of the oppressors, to preach to the prisoners, and to open the blind eyes. And then Jesus went and did those miracles. And there's records of people doing miracles in the Bible, in the Old Testament, but no one physically opened blind eyes, I don't think. I can't see it in the Old Testament anywhere. So the first record we have of someone opening blind eyes was the Messiah. The miracle was the sign that that was who he was. So the miracles pointed to Jesus. That's why they were signs. They pointed and said, this is who I am. I am the Messiah. Look at these things I do. And people misread the signs and started accusing him of being from the devil, accusing him of being demon-possessed. And it didn't hold up. And it started with Jesus sort of denying that, and then his disciples denied it. And then the people started saying, actually, this doesn't work. Why would a demon-possessed man do these good things that he's doing among us? And so that doesn't hold water. So these signs point to Jesus as being the Messiah. But if signs point to Jesus or tell us where to go, they're also signposts. And J. John says that these miracles were signs along the way, and they're pointing to Jesus saying, this is the way you should go. And Jesus himself says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So the miracles that we see in the Bible that Jesus does are pointing to him saying, I am the Messiah, and I'm leading you to the Father. And so when Jesus ever does a miracle, he is releasing people, he is saving people, and he is saying, come to me, come follow me, and I will follow you, and I will help you to lead the way to the Father. And the early Christians, before they were called Christians, were called followers of the way, because that's what they said they were doing. They were following the way that Jesus led. So we read that in the early chapters of Acts, when the people who are persecuting them call them the followers of the way. And they are trying to follow the way through to heaven, to the Father. And they're seeing these signs and they're seeing these wonders, they're seeing these miracles, even in the book of Acts. And they're all pointing now to the apostles who are pointing to Jesus, who is pointing to the Father. And so these signposts, these signs and wonders are supposed to direct us. But whenever you come across a sign, I don't know if you've ever driven up to a crossroads or to a roundabout, and you slow down a little bit or hold back so that you get a clear picture of the sign, because maybe you're in a place you don't know and you need to know where you go. So these signs, you come to this crossroad and you say, I wonder which way to go. And these miracles are made to be signs, and they're made to stop us. They're made to make us think. They're made to make us wonder where we'd go next. And we have a choice when we come to a crossroads. Which journey do we take? When I was at Sunday school, I used to sing a song, some of you may know it as well, I met Jesus at the crossroads, where the two ways meet. Satan, he was standing there, he said, come this way, there's lots and lots of treasures I can give to you today. But I said, no, there's Jesus here. And I can't remember the rest. Sorry? See what he offers me. Down here a life forgiven, up there a home in heaven. Thank you, Jean. Praise God, that's the way for me. When we come to these crossroads in our life, we can stop. And we have a choice. We can either choose the tiny little treasures that the Satan offers or that the world offers, or we can consider and we can choose Jesus. And we can follow the signs. And in our life, these signs are supposed to direct us, and they're supposed to be markers along our way. I believe we're supposed to be seeing signs and wonders and miracles in our daily life, in our church life, in our family life. And we do see them, don't we? And we celebrate when we see them. But I'm not sure, personally, I don't think that we see them as regularly as we would like to, if we can say that. I'm not sure we're seeing cancer being healed as regularly as we would like. Maybe you disagree with that. But personally, I would love to see much more signs and wonders in our church, in our family, in our world, because I think they're signs of pointing to Jesus. And I want the world to be coming in with their darkness and seeing the light, coming in with their confusion and hearing the word and finding Jesus and finding salvation. So if we're not seeing them, the first question is why and what can we do to do that? But is there something else that the people see? Is there something else that today our generation, our community can see and are coming to? Are we supposed to do these great events that people just love to come and be entertained, like they thought of the miracles at the beginning? And when I thought about, well, what do we do that people might come to, first my thought was coffee, because we're quite proud of our coffee here, aren't we, Kelly? And we said about the hub at the beginning. I can remember at the leaders' meeting that we had, one of the first things we discussed was, how are we going to provide coffee for all these people? And Kelly went and sourced, was it 60 litres of coffee could be made at any one point? He was literally turning water into coffee. and we've got this reputation of having good, I don't like coffee, to be honest, but that's by the by. But coffee is something that people come and just have a coffee. And we do that, don't we, whether it's in church or just come and have a chat. Come and have a coffee, let's go to a cafe, let's sit and let's chat. Coffee does attract people, or tea, or cake, or chocolate, or whatever it is. So should we be making sure we do these good things, provide these good meals and resources and things that people are attracted to? Is it good, is it right that we use our breakfasts or our curry nights as a sign of people to come into our building? Is that right? Okay, they're just coming for entertainment. But Jesus seems to think that that's not too bad. When he says, I know you won't believe unless you see these signs and wonders, he is still using these signs and wonders to draw a crowd. And he's not saying, go away. He's saying, look, yes, I'm happy to entertain you. And sometimes that entertainment leads to belief. And sometimes for some people, that entertainment needs to be there so that they believe. And we need to be providing good things for our community to come into. But it's not just enough. Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. Those signs need to lead somewhere. They need to lead to belief. So it's not just enough to put on a good show, to put on a good carol concert or whatever else. We need to be witnessing to our community. And I believe the answer as to what they see now is in the book of Matthew, where in Matthew chapter 5, we have that great story of the Beatitudes, the great account of the Beatitudes, with Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount. And he starts to talk about how his followers, how his disciples are salt and light to the world. And he says, do these things so that people, you are salt and light, so that people may see your good deeds and praise the Father in heaven. So Jesus is now saying that we are the signs, the good deeds that we do, whatever it is in your workplace, you are the sign. You are an embodiment of a miracle. When Jesus died on that cross, and he hung there, and he died, and was put in the grave, and was raised back to life, he made a way for us to die in our selfless, sinful bodies and be resurrected in spiritual life. That is the greatest miracle ever, the miracle of salvation that only Jesus could have done. And we are an embodiment of that. And so when we go out, our signs, our wonders, our good deeds, as it says in Matthew 5, are the things that people will see so that they praise the Father in heaven. So you are a signpost. When you're next at your workplace, or you're next at the coffee house, or you're next at your I don't know, whatever you go to on a Monday morning or throughout the week, when you're serving in Noah's Ark, you are a signpost. People are going to see you, see your good deeds, and that leads to a conversation. That leads to a little bit of hope. That leads to the miracle of salvation. And that's what we want to be seeing. So as a church, we need to be putting on these things that are going to entertain people, that are going to attract a crowd. We talk about creating a fringe around our church so that we can draw people in. And we need to do those things. But that's not enough just to leave it there. We need to be salt and light in our communities. We need to be living our lives in such a way that people say, there's something different about you. I'm not sure what. But you're not quite the same as this person in the next cubicle. You're not quite the same as the other laborer that works for me. What is different about you? And our lives need to be those signposts. We need to be embodying that miracle of salvation and attracting people to Jesus. So the other thing we said, we read it slowly, we meditate upon it, and we put ourselves into the story. So where would you be in this story? Are you like the crowd who have just come because you've heard a few rumors about what Jesus can do? You've heard a few rumors about what the church does, and you're just coming for entertainment. You're coming to see something. You're coming to get something. And if that's you, you are extremely welcome, and we would love to talk to you more. We would love to help you out, as Kelly said earlier about those new here cards. We want to help to serve you. And if you've come here this morning just looking and just slightly interested in what Christianity is, what the church is, what our church is, then we would love to talk to you. Maybe you've come and you're like the man, that royal official. Maybe you've come and you're desperate for God. You're desperate for Jesus to break in. You're desperate in your workplace. You're desperate in your health situation. You're desperate in your finances. You need to see breakthrough in whatever circumstance it is. You've tried to fix it yourself. You've got support from doctors and other people elsewhere. Nothing seems to be working. We believe in a God who heals. And if you are desperate in whatever situation that is to see breakthrough in your life, we would love to pray for you this morning and spend some time just helping you see who Jesus is and praying that he will do a miracle, not in the way we expect, but in how he has planned for you. Maybe you're the boy. Maybe you're at home and you're at a distance and maybe you're not even sure about what's going on. You don't even know where your dad is. But you just need something in your life. You're not even sure what that is. And I was just thinking about this. I wonder when they found out that boy had been healed. Because they were looking for that sign. And maybe that word filtered back fairly quickly, I don't know. I quite like the idea of some old grey man sitting, reading the first copy of the book of John and think, get into chapter 4 and thinking, ah, he did get better after all. I saw that miracle. Well, I didn't see it, but I was there when he said it. I quite like that idea, but I don't know if that's true. But when did they find out that that miracle had happened? It was done at a distance. Maybe some of them never found out. And then I got thinking, maybe there's something that God has already put in place that we've not yet discovered that is going to completely change your life. God has a plan for you. And maybe already he has instigated a change in the future that you just need to go and discover. And you need to walk along that journey, and you need to walk through that difficulty, still looking and hoping and praying for that breakthrough, still pressing in. But God has already got it in control. He knows what he's going to do. He's not waiting until it gets to that moment, say, right, now is the time. He's not waiting for you to say the perfect prayer or to walk those 17 miles for 8 hours. He's already knowing what you need. And he's putting things in place for your salvation, for your healing, for your future, which is just an amazing thing to think about, isn't it? God, who is outside of time, can interact with us at our point of deepest need, even before we know that is going to be our point of deepest need. Maybe you're like the servant. Maybe you have a message to tell. Maybe you have a story to bring of how you have seen God's salvation, you have seen God's healing, you have seen this thing that's happened, and you need to get up and you need to go. And I can't quite work out why it's the next day that the servant gets to the man. If it was me, I think Jesus said, go, son would be healed. I'd like to think that I would literally go. And I know I've traveled for 7 or 8 hours already, but I don't get why that distance is there. There's some things in the Bible that we need to think about more and we need to get. But I don't think it matters too much. What we need to see is that man had faith in God. And when Jesus said, go, your son will be healed, he believed him at his word. He wasn't any longer just looking for fleshly solutions. He wasn't just looking for a sign and a wonder. He was taking Jesus at his word. The word that became flesh is the most important thing. Not the flesh that he came in, but the word that he brings. And that word can make a huge difference in our life. And that's what we need to be searching for. What is God saying in your situation? How is God speaking to you today? So as we look at this passage, we can see that Jesus cares about us. We can see how Jesus wants to interact. He wants to heal us, how he wants to save us, and how he wants us to come to him. Would he have healed that boy if that man hadn't come? Sometimes in life there are things we have to do to make ourselves available, to humble ourselves, to put ourselves in a situation of receivership. If we're proud, if we don't go to God in the first place, maybe he doesn't work that miracle. So this morning, is there something that we need to do? Is there a place that we need to go? Like the man, do we have to go on this journey to find Jesus, to seek him, and to kneel at his feet and say, would you please work in my situation? Is that something that we need to do? But what that man definitely does is he takes Jesus at his word, and he believes. And he goes home, and it says his whole family believed, which meant he must have then discussed it with his friends and his family for them to believe as well. And that's what we have to be doing. As we're going through and we're hearing and we're learning and we're feeling all these things that God is doing for us, we can't just keep it inside. We have to let it go. We have to give it to the community. We have to be that sign, be that witness that people will stop and think and wonder, should I follow this way? Or should I follow that way? And I think by if we are doing that, if we are witnessing, if we are talking about what God is doing in our lives, and I think we will see it more. If we have more darkness coming into our church, I'm sure the light of God will be breaking through more regularly. And that's what we want, isn't it? We want to be salt and light in our community so that people see our good deeds and praise our Father in heaven.